Hi, welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 99 for July 8th, 2007. Coming up in a few minutes.
Fully mature Woodford Reserve was too rich in flavor. But if we would get a four-year-old or a five-year-old barrel profile and place that in wine finishes, then we started seeing some really interesting developments.
That's Chris Morris, the master distiller at Woodford Reserve. If you like Scotch whiskies with a wine finish, just wait. Chris has a new bourbon that you're going to want to try. That's coming up later, but first, there's a lot of news to talk about this week. In the last episode, I mentioned that India's government was expected to cut the import tariffs on whiskeys and other spirits after pressure from the European Union and the U.S. This week, that's exactly what the government in New Delhi did. While it's not a perfect ending, David Williamson of the Scotch Whiskey Association says it's good enough for now.
And it's welcome because it's a big step towards fairer competition in the market. And it's also good news for the Indian consumer who finally will be able to have a greater choice of, you know, internationally renowned Scotch whisky brands.
Now, is it fair to say that you can live with a tariff scheme or a tax scheme that doesn't penalize imports as long as it treats imports and domestic producers the same?
Our key here has always been that there should not be discrimination between imported products and domestic products. What the Indian government has announced is that the discriminatory element of the tax regime, which has been in place since 2001, has been removed. And that is good news for the industry, who for the first time will be able to compete on equal terms in the market. At the same time, though, the reform of the system is not going to transform the Scotch whisky market in India overnight, but it does open up new possibilities. We certainly will be also looking at other issues within the market, such as the basic duty of 150%, which is still very high by international standards. But our key priority has been to remove the discrimination, and that's what's taken place.
Now, so there still is 150% duty, but the additional 150% is gone.
Yes, basically, until the removal of the additional duty, Scotch whisky imported into India was faced by an overall tariff burden of as much as 550%. With the removal of the duty, that tariff burden is now 150%, the basic customs duty, albeit there will be state-level taxes and levies to be paid. The important difference, though, is that with the removal of the discrimination, there will be a level playing field in the market with domestic products and imported products facing the same taxes within different states.
And how important is this market? We've talked about this before, but just how critical is it to the industry to get access to India?
Well, fair access to the Indian market is the SWA's top international trade priority. It's a market of significant potential for Scotch whisky distillers, both large and small. At the moment, because of the discrimination that's been in place, the Scotch whisky accounts for less than 1% of the Indian spirits market. That's a market of around 120 million cases. With the removal of the discrimination, while, as I say, the market won't be transformed overnight, clearly, with a level playing field in which to operate, there will be a significant potential for growth for Scotch whisky distillers in India.
By the way, the wine industry is not happy. Wine imports used to be assessed a 100% import duty, but the Indian government raised that to the same 150% assessed on spirits, just to make things equal. Of course, there are cynics pointing out that the Indian government's decision conveniently came after Indian magnate Vijay Mallya, who is also a member of parliament, bought White & Mackay a couple of months ago. He needs the lower tariffs to make imports of White & Mackay whiskies into India pay off. Speaking of White & Mackay, Managing Director Bob Brannan announced his departure from the company this week. Brannan had been with White & Mackay for a little more than 2 years, and he told the Scotsman he wants a new challenge involving more than running an overseas subsidiary. However, Brannan has nothing but praise for Vijay Mallya, and he says his departure doesn't mean any other major changes in the leadership at White & Mackay. Last year, Art Begg brought out the most expensive bottling in the distillery's history, the $4,000 Art Begg 1965. Now that's the second most expensive bottling in Art Begg history. Picture this. Two bottles of cask-strength Art Begg 1974, both from different casks. The bottles are hand-blown and individually numbered, packaged in a shotgun-style case made of hand-stitched bridle leather, along with 8 solid silver cups from Scottish silversmith Hamilton and Inches. And try saying solid silver cups from Scottish silversmith 3 times real fast, if you will. Now, only 250 sets will be available at a suggested retail price of $20,000 each. Start saving now. The double barrel bottling will be available in October. The yachts are gathering along Scotland's west coast for this year's Classic Malts Cruise. Nick Morgan is the global marketing director for Diageo's Classic Malts, and he'll be on one of the first boats out of Oban next Sunday.
Well, what's involved is a fantastic fortnight's cruising for the guests that join us from all over the world, leaving Oban on Sunday morning on the 15th of July, sailing north to Talisker. Most of the boats that are with us will arrive at Talisker about 5 days later. We have a big Cayley for them to celebrate the fact that for a lot of them it's probably the most northerly place they will ever sail to. And then the boats have a lovely time sailing down from Talisker to Islay to be there at the end of the following week on the 26th of July. They'll probably call in, many of them, at Kalila before going round to Lagavulin, and we end the cruise there with a very traditional Islay Cayley.
How did this get started?
The event started, Mark, in 1994, and it was originally set up to as part of the celebrations of the 200th anniversary of the founding of Oban Distillery in 1794. And I have to say, it would be doing the event a huge piece of flattery, really, to say that it was a cruise. It was really no more than 3 or 4 boats, mostly made up of company personnel who decided to take the opportunity of this anniversary to sail around a few of our distilleries. And the cruise as such didn't really start to take on any scale until about 1998, which was when we really started reaching out to sailors, not just in Scotland, but around the world, to come and join us.
And since then, it's grown to more than 100 boats, correct?
Well, actually, it's grown and it shrunk, because in 2000, we had a huge event, and we had 200 boats sailing with us, which, to be frank, logistically was a bit of a nightmare, and from a safety point of view, it was, let's say, challenging. So after the 2000 event, we decided that we would really cap the number of participants to 100, and each year since then, we've had between 90 and 100 boats joining us.
How does one take part?
Well, if you want to take part, there's a simple process of registering with the partners who help us run the event, who are called World Cruising Club. They look after all the people who come and join us. You register, you pay a relatively modest, I think, registration fee, and then all you have to do is get your crew and your boat up to Oban for the start of the event on the 15th of July. Obviously, this year the event is pretty closed because we have a full list, but we'll be taking entrants for next year's cruise in a few months' time.
What's the most enjoyable part of the whole Classic Malts cruise?
Well, I think that's a hard one to answer because there are so many different aspects that get shrunk into this fortnight. For many people, it's simply coming and sailing in what are some of the most unspoiled waters in the world. The west coast of Scotland is one of the most pleasurable sailing grounds. You can, even on an event like this where we have 100 boats, you can set sail in the morning and not see another yacht for the whole day or maybe for several days. But what you might see are minke whales, killer whales, dolphins, porpoise, basking sharks, and a range of seabirds beyond compare. So there's the whole natural beauty of Scotland to enjoy and savor. And, of course, then there's the whiskey as well. And I think for many of our guests, it's a marvelous combination of the sailing and then the sociability that they experience. And for many, I think coming to our distilleries and sitting down and chatting with the people that actually make the whiskey and getting to know them a little as well.
And the 3 distilleries that are involved put on some special events, correct?
That's right. We have an event at Oban when we start off. And on the morning of the 15th, when the boats leave Oban, we have a big parade of sail around Oban Bay. And then again, the cruisers will all join up at Talisker 5 or 6 days later for a big ceilidh there. And then again, at the end of the event, on the 27th of July, everyone will meet up again at Lagavulin. And that really, after a fortnight's sailing, the Lagavulin event is something that has to be experienced.
What happens at Lagavulin?
Well, it's
give me a sense of what's going on that night.
Well, I'll tell you, what's been going on all day is that people have been coming up to the distillery, having tours, having tastings. And then the ceilidh kicks off with a dram in the courtyard, sometimes some dancing if it's not raining. We then have a fantastic buffet laid on for us by the guys at the Port Charlotte Hotel, which focuses in on local Islay produce, so oysters, lobsters, Islay beef. So we have a fantastic meal. And then we have local bands playing in one of the distillery buildings, and probably a lot of cruisers will bring their instruments ashore as well. So we have a proper ceilidh and a big dance.
And I imagine that goes on until well into the night.
It does, and it carries on. And these sort of events, people tend to go back to their boats, and they carry on until the very early hours.
What's the best memory you have of one of these cruises?
Oh, that's a hard one. I've done so many and met so many wonderful people. Mark, you've put me on the spot. I would actually think it was sailing into Talisker 3 years ago, after one of the hardest journeys that I've ever experienced at sea, and certainly the skipper of my boat shared that view. And we had no communication for a few days, and the weather had been absolutely appalling, and I was very doubtful as to whether anyone would have arrived at Talisker. And we turned around the corner into sailing into Lough Harport. The clouds disappeared, the sun came out, there were about 90 boats there, and I think everyone had such a joyous celebration of having experienced a real adventure at sea. But then we'd all sort of come home together. It was really a great evening. It was quite fantastic.
I can imagine. That must have been wonderful.
Yeah, truly wonderful, truly wonderful. And we had a gorgeous sunset as well, so that just was icing on the cake.
Nick and I talked about a lot more than just the cruise, and you'll hear more of our discussion on an upcoming episode, including a sneak peek at some of this fall's Classic Malts releases. Coming up on the calendar of events, the Australian chapter of the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society has its Old Alliance dinner in Melbourne on the 14th. The guys at New Jersey's Whiskey Guild have a tasting event on the 16th at the Dark Horse in Morristown. Jeff Topping's Wild Scotsman Whiskey Society has a Scotch tasting with George Grant of Glenfarclas at Nicholson's in Cincinnati on the 21st. And the Park East Grill in New York City has a tasting on July 23rd. There's a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. There's a lot of debate over whiskey finishes. Some people like them, some hate them. Of course, if you're a bourbon lover, the debate has been academic until now. Since bourbon by law must be aged in new American oak barrels, that would seem to rule out any experiments with finishing. But Woodford Reserve master distiller Chris Morris found a way to make his bourbon work with, believe it or not, a Chardonnay finish. In the words of the late great Desi Arnaz, Chris, you got some splaining to do here.
Well,
what's this with the Chardonnay finish?
Well, you know, the single malt business really gave itself a shot in the arm, or was reborn with the wood finish concept pioneered by the good old fellows at Glenmorangie, and using port pipes and sherry butts and Madeira drums and a whole list of other wine casks. Started creating a whole new range of really interesting flavor profiles. And bourbon had not been very successful at doing that. Other companies had tried, as you know, in the past. But bourbon whiskey, because it's its primary or first maturation period is always in a new charred oak barrel, has a very rich, robust flavor that tends to overshadow any subtle wine characteristics that might be derived from a wine finish. But still, you'd be negligent in not experimenting. So since 1999, we have tried Woodford Reserve in some various types of wine finish profile. And not to our surprise, Woodford Reserve would overshadow whatever wine influence we were looking for. So we decided to really get more in balance with the flavor profile we were looking for, and decided to use barrels of Woodford Reserve that wouldn't qualify for Woodford Reserve as Woodford Reserve because they were of a younger age. So fully mature Woodford Reserve was too rich in flavor. But if we would get a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old barrel profile and place that in wine finishes, then we started seeing some really interesting developments. And then because we're an all-American spirit, and Woodford Reserve, of course, is Kentucky bred, we decided not to go the route with European wine finishes and look to our own nation for inspiration. And that led us to great brands such as Sonoma-Cutrer, the Grand Cru of the California Chardonnays, as an experiment among others. And that to me was one of the most interesting combinations of letting a 4 to 5 year old Woodford Reserve spirit rest in a freshly dumped California Chardonnay barrel just gave us a whole new flavor experience. So I think we hit on something that's uniquely American and that a true bourbon connoisseur will really enjoy.
Now, from my experience with wines, and I'm not a wine expert by any stretch of the imagination.
Put me on that list.
It seems like a Chardonnay would be too light to have much influence at all on a bourbon, and it would just be completely overpowered. But it seems to work in this case now?
Well, it works also because I think, to be honest, Mark, Woodford Reserve, as you know, is not just any bourbon whiskey. It's a very complex bourbon. It's very fruity. It's very spicy. It has all five areas of bourbon flavor: sweet aromatics, grain, and wood character, nutty character as well. And what the Sonoma-Cutrer brought to the Woodford Reserve flavor profile is an emboldenment of some of the flavor characteristics that you would find in Woodford Reserve. And if you know, and as I've learned from working with the winemaker at Sonoma-Cutrer, Terry Adams, a great Chardonnay will bring with it apple, lemon, pineapple, citrusy fruit flavors. Obviously, it's wine, these big estuary notes. And that's what it really highlighted in Woodford Reserve, our hint of citrus, our nice balance of apple, and then that brought along with it some of the buttery, creamy notes of the Chardonnay combined with our caramel and vanilla and giving it a nice butterscotchy character, caramelly character, and then just on its own at 5 years, 4.5 years, the Woodford Reserve has a nice cinnamon note to it. So I ended up on the palate with describing it as a slice of apple pie with a dollop of vanilla ice cream on it.
I know the answer to this, but I'm sure that there's going to be some questions about it, that the standard for bourbon is strictly aged in American oak barrels. It doesn't say, it doesn't provide anything for finishing, but as long as you meet the original standards for bourbon, you can do this, right?
Yes. Now, this product of Woodford Reserve Distillery's Master's Collection Sonoma-Cutrer finish, it's probably one of the longest brand names in the bourbon industry, is not technically a bourbon whiskey. It is a bourbon whiskey, fully matured bourbon whiskey, finished in a Chardonnay barrel. So it's bourbon whiskey. It was fully matured when we took the Woodford Reserve out of the original barrel, finished it, so now it becomes a whiskey specialty. But you would recognize it as a bourbon whiskey on the palate, on the nose, the color, of course. And our descriptor, our legal descriptor that was approved by the federal government is Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey finished in California Chardonnay barrels.
And obviously the first of its kind, realistically.
Yes.
To be fair, it should be pointed out that Woodford Reserve and Sonoma-Cutrer are part of the same corporate family, right?
That's right. That gave us a great leg up. We had been acquiring barrels from other companies and thought, hey, let's not go far afield when we have the most acclaimed California Chardonnay in our own stable, as we would say in the Woodford Reserve vernacular, 16 years out of the last 18, Sonoma-Cutrer has been voted as the favorite Chardonnay by America's restaurant industry because it's only been available through the restaurant trade. You cannot go out to a package store and buy a bottle of Sonoma-Cutrer. Now you can with the Sonoma-Cutrer Sonoma Coast, but it's a very hard to get prestigious Chardonnay. And because of its Grand Cru style, its very flinty, mineral-driven terroir, it has its own limestone base. And a lot of how that brand has been developed and is created each and every year mimics what we do at Woodford Reserve. So it was a ideological fit, it was a flavor fit, and then it was a corporate fit as well.
And the limestone characteristics really sort of work well with the bourbon because there's a lot of limestone out in Kentucky, and it sort of works with the springs and everything out there.
It sure did. With their wood management, how they craft barrels, how we have special barrels crafted for Woodford Reserve, the terroir, everything just really came together, and it was, we were talking the same language.
They're bottling the new Woodford Reserve Sonoma-Cutrer this week, and it'll be available in 18 U.S. states starting later this month. By the way, there are only 900 cases available, and you'll find a link to the Woodford Reserve website at the WhiskeyCast website. That's all for this episode of WhiskeyCast. Next time around, episode number 100. Coming up in the next few weeks, I'll talk with master distiller Ian Henderson and put your questions to the experts in the first question and answer episode. Of course, my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2007, and comes to you from the charming yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.